a new state rental assistance program, Woody Meyer's criminal justice reform plan, plus Mike Braun's qualified immunity bill, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending June 26th, 2020.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, thousands of Hoosier renters facing eviction in the coming weeks might get a little help from the state after officials announced the creation of a rental assistance program. The new program will provide $500 a month for 4 months to people who've lost income during the pandemic. Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority Director Jacob Seip notes that won't cover full rent.
In Indiana, the median rent is $825. So it's important that the household continue to work with their landlords to make a payment plan to make those payments.
Landlords have to agree to participate in the program for Hoosiers to get help. Asked what people should do if their landlords won't participate, Seip only urged renters to talk with their landlords. Governor Eric Holcomb did announce he's extending the ban on evictions through the end of July. The program is available for Hoosiers in 91 of 92 counties. Marion County has its own program. People can begin applying July 13th. Does this program go far enough? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Jennifer Hollowell, the Hoosier Housing Needs Coalition estimates that even when taking into account Marion County's separate program, about 200,000 households statewide will still be left without help. Does this program go far enough?
Well, I think for some people, nothing will go far enough, but I would say it's meaningful. It's something important and a step that we can do, $500 a month for 4 months for the folks who are able to receive that. And keep in mind, this is just one state program. There are other programs that can help folks locally as well. And it's also just one of many things that Governor Holcomb has done to provide relief during this pandemic situation. You know, this comes on top of early moves that would prevent evictions for individuals who weren't able to pay their rent. It also comes on top of the governor's move that suspended utility companies or prevented utility companies from shutting off utilities for folks. So all of these things layered on top of each other are very meaningful and help to provide relief to those who need it.
Ann Delaney, when I talked to the Hoosier Housing Needs Coalition about this, they called it a good start. Is that how you see it?
That's exactly what it is. It's recognition of the problem, but it's a Band-Aid on a bullet wound. I mean, we have 200,000 people who can't pay their rent in the month of August, in the month of July, and this is going to help 5% of them? I mean, that's simply not enough. I mean, we have people who are, we're going to be facing a homelessness crisis pretty soon when the moratorium on evictions takes place. We're going to have a huge number of those taking place, and that's going to present hardship for so many families. We simply need to do more, and, you know, you can't take the little tiny steps that the governor likes to take for each problem that he recognizes when the problem is as overwhelming as this is.
Nikki Kelly, I think one thing that jumped out to a lot of people here was the idea that landlords have to agree to participate in order for these Hoosiers to get help. Did we really get much of a sense on why that is?
Not at all. I think several of us asked about that, and I was never given a good explanation on why they have to agree to participate. My assumption is that it's something with them maybe agreeing not to file an eviction, or because they don't want to give the money to a person and then rely on them to pass it on to the landlord. Maybe it's so they can give it directly to the landlord through their accounts. I'm not sure, but I would like to hear that explanation.
And John Schwannis, one thing we heard from Jacob Seip, the IHCDA director, in terms of all of these issues, not only, you know, what do you do if
your landlord refuses to participate, but also just in general, they've been urging folks to talk with their landlords this entire time through the pandemic. Talk to your landlord about why you're unable to pay, what you can do to set up a payment plan. Do you think it's reasonable for every Hoosier to expect that their landlord will be happy to work with them, though?
No, I think it would be pretty foolhardy to think that every single tenant in need of this kind of assistance would find a sympathetic ear with their landlords. But that is still very good advice, whether you're dealing with landlords, whether you're dealing with other creditors, banks that may have issued your credit cards or your car loans. I think it's good sense to, in a situation like this, to not to just sort of disappear as if you were in the fugitive witness or, you know, witness protection program, but rather to be open with the creditor and try to see if there might be some terms that could be agreed to. So sound advice of with all creditors, it seems to me. But will it work for everyone? I think that would be the tall order.
And I think the other problem with this is it overly complicates the problem, as most of their solutions do. You have a grant program. You've got to do all of these different things. We have a lot of out-of-state landlords. Getting in touch with your landlord can be a full-time job.
One thing the Hoosier Housing Needs Coalition did note is that it's a good idea to talk to your landlord, even if they end up being obstinate and refusing to participate, because that can actually help you when you have to go to court over an eviction proceeding. Because if your landlord says, no, I refuse to participate in the state program, and then tries to evict you, that's not going to look great to a judge. Now, Democratic gubernatorial candidate Woody Myers unveiled a criminal justice reform plan this week that mandates new training for police, shifts funding to social services, and decriminalizes marijuana. The Myers plan includes reducing the prison population, investing in minority communities, measures to address police brutality, and more oversight of law enforcement. He does not agree with the phrase defund the police, though parts of his plan align with some who advocate that policy. For instance, he wants to see mental health professionals address what he views as mental health challenges.
I would just prefer that we do more of that. So that our police can truly deal with the violent crimes that are out there.
Myers does not call for curtailing the power of police unions, which many have pushed for in recent weeks.
I worry about imposing a set of conditions without the opportunity, at least, for dialogue, without the opportunity, at least, to bring the unions along.
Myers does want greater transparency in police union contracts. And Delaney, I think the question a lot of people ask is, what is the point of pursuing meaningful criminal justice and police reforms without addressing the power of police unions?
You know, these are meaningful reforms. And in sharp contrast with the current occupant of the governor's office, this is a plan. We haven't heard anything from him on this. But what's good about this is there's a lot the state can do. The state can give incentive to governments for training. They can have incentives for a real civilian review board with teeth in it. They can share information about the police officers who are problem officers around the state. There are many, and they can outlaw certain kinds of conduct. And they can deal with the same thing that Senator Braun is dealing with. So there's a lot that they can do. I think that the dialogue with the police unions is a good idea, because I do think it's in the interests of most of the police, who I think are good people trying to do a job and protect the public. It's in their interest as well to have a method of rooting out the bad seeds in those unions. Because if the police department doesn't have the confidence and the cooperation of the citizenry, they can't do their job, and they're at risk. So I think it would be a good thing to open up that dialogue. You cannot protect, cannot use the unions simply to protect bad apples. They need a way to be weeded out, and the unions need to help in determining what that way is.
Jennifer Hollowell, is there needed reform when it comes to police unions?
I think there is. I think Ann and I agree on quite a bit on this topic. But I would say a couple of things. First, around the country over the last decade, we've seen increased transparency as it relates to teachers' union contracts and some changes in those processes in certain states specifically. But I don't think we've seen the same kinds of conversations and transparency in police union contracts. And I do think that, you know, shining a light on the details is something that could be very helpful in figuring out what kind of reforms are needed. You know, I have spoken with several friends who are police officers and friends of police officers, and all say relatively the same thing, that good police officers cannot stand bad police officers, and they don't want to be serving alongside of them. And I think that there is an appetite among the vast majority who are serving our communities so well and keeping us safe to find solutions that can help weed out those bad officers. And when you have situations where there have been dozens or more complaints, and that's not to say that all complaints are valid. I think we know very well that that's not the case. But there has to be some sort of process put into place that can allow the weeding out of the bad actors, and so that we can strengthen the faith that everyone has in our law enforcement officers.
John, generally speaking, the Democratic Party is a staunch advocate for organized labor, and that would include a police union. And yet we are hearing increasingly about progressive advocates saying we need to curtail at minimum the power of police unions. So is the Democratic Party on this issue going to have to come to some sort of reckoning here?
That's an astute observation. It is an uncomfortable position for a lot of Democratic office holders around the country, because as you point out, they tend to be able to look to organized labor as a traditional, strong, staunch advocate of Democratic politics. Now, having said that, we have seen the FOP various jurisdictions go with Republican endorse Republican candidates in some of the recent cycles. So it's not a complete, the love isn't always returned, you might say. That history notwithstanding, though, you're right. Something will need to change. Transparency probably is the answer. You look at a lot of the proposals, transparency touches on, say, mandated use of police body cameras. Why? More transparency. It might have greater use of civilian review boards. Why? More transparency. So it seems the natural progression is that the negotiated contracts with labor would also receive new public scrutiny, again, in keeping with that same notion of let the fresh air in, let everybody see what's going on so that we can build trust.
And then, Nikki, aside from just the police union issue, as you look at sort of this reform package, some of it would need to be legislative, some of it maybe not, but is there much of a chance in your mind that the General Assembly, whatever it looks like in 2021, would engage on a lot of these issues?
Yeah, I think they will engage. I think there will probably be hearings on a number of these. I mean, I'm not going to go as far as to say every single one of them would make it across the finish line, but I do think that these protests and these cases that have brought some of these problems to light are making, you know, a difference, and there will at least be a sincere discussion of a lot of these in the session.
All right. Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Eismiller email and text alerts. This week's question: should police unions' collective bargaining rights be curtailed? A, yes, or B, no. In last week's question, we asked you who will win the 2020 race for Indiana Attorney General. 49% of you say it'll be the Democrat, Jonathan Weinzapfel, while 51% say it'll be the Republican candidate, which we will find out about in a couple weeks. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, it was just mentioned a little while ago by Ann Delaney, but Indiana U.S. Senator Mike Braun this week introduced a bill to reform qualified immunity, a controversial legal standard that has shielded many police officers who commit misconduct from lawsuits. Qualified immunity is a legal defense for government employees against civil suits, as long as their conduct didn't violate a clearly established statutory or constitutional right. But Hoosier Republican Senator Mike Braun says courts have interpreted it too broadly, protecting law enforcement officers who he says have committed egregious acts like assaulting unarmed and nonviolent people and releasing a police dog on someone who'd surrendered. Braun's bill would rewrite qualified immunity, requiring government employees, like police, to prove that their conduct was authorized by a statute or court case.
Nikki Kelly, we've already seen some pushback from
Republicans on this. Tucker Carlson went on a rant about Mike Braun on his program recently, and I believe Greg Pence, Congressman Greg Pence, has an op-ed now in the Indy Star that comes out against this sort of qualified immunity reform. Are you surprised, then, that a bill like this comes from Republican Mike Braun?
I am a little bit surprised, but I'm really glad he is trying to open up the dialogue on this. I know, you know, I covered state and federal courts for a couple of years solidly, and I can't even begin to tell you case after case after case after case was just dismissed before you would ever even get to hear the merits of it, before it could really be judged. And so I definitely think it's a good conversation to have and applaud him for starting it.
John Schwanes, we just had a discussion about police unions and their tendency to endorse not solely Democrats, but Republicans in a lot of cases. Any concern for Mike Braun here on blowback to proposing something like this?
Well, you weigh things. Do you want the particular endorsement from a particular union, or do you want to carve out a reputation as a practical lawmaker who can find the middle ground between polarized sides of an issue? And I think Mike Braun did get a lot of very positive attention, maybe not from Tucker Carlson, but from other news organizations that might be considered more mainstream, that said, hey, here's a guy who is trying to find the middle ground. And one thing I think we, after 4 years now of a lot of polarization, it does seem that on some of these issues, there's a recognition on the part of the public that the only way that we are going to see any kind of movement or real progress is if we have something that can at least garner the support of a majority, because otherwise, you know, between filibusters and the ability of committee chairs to deep six most proposals, we're not going to get very far.
I should note that there were conservative groups who came out in favor of Senator Braun's proposal this week, so it wasn't like it was only getting pushback from, or Republicans were the only ones giving pushback. But Jennifer Hollowell, is this the sort of reform that we need?
I think that, first of all, I'm not terribly surprised that Senator Braun brought this forward, because we've seen him act in the past 2 years in a way that there's a bit of an independent streak, I believe, and he's clearly a problem solver and someone who's not afraid to tackle big issues. He's been outspoken on climate change and a couple of other things. So from that standpoint, it's not surprising. This is a really, really complicated subject. And so it is important to have dialogue and, frankly, for everyone to understand it better. You know, police are not immune when they're committing a crime. The complicated issue here is that in these cases, sometimes they act in a way that is in the scope of their duty that is different, right? That in any other instance might be considered that. And so I think what we need to do first is have a much better understanding of what the situation is, and then act in such a way. This is all the more reason why we need more training for police officers. We need to be more serious about funding training police officers. And we also need to make sure that all of the kind of standard operating procedures and all of those measures are in place. Some of the things we talked about in the last question, that all of that is more firmed up. But we also have to be really careful that we don't put police officers in a position where they are vulnerable to lawsuits and could go bankrupt if we're trying to parse things out. I'm just saying we need to figure these things out, and we also don't want to drive good police officers out of this profession. So it's a complicated issue. I do not have all the answers, but I think we could have a thoughtful dialogue.
And I do want to ask this, which is, as you look at Braun's proposal through the eyes of a lawyer, does he try to strike that right balance?
I think he deserves a lot of credit, as Jennifer said, for opening the dialogue. I don't think the way he's approached it is the right way. Nikki is correct. The way the courts, and I mean that the activist Republican judges on the courts, have created this doctrine, and it isn't a defense, it's almost an absolute bar. And by the way, it's not the police that go bankrupt. They may be named in the lawsuit, but the city pays, and the city always pays, or the county, or the whatever it is, whatever the law enforcement jurisdiction is. It's not the individual officer, number one. Number two is the way it seems to me you handle it. Instead of having this as an absolute bar, because you could be criminally convicted of the police officer could be criminally convicted for his conduct and still be immune in the civil system. That is a crazy result. So what we do with that is you take away the absolute immunity and you use it as an affirmative defense, yeah. Not the way Senator Braun has set it up. But if somebody comes and files a civil suit, you have an affirmative defense that you are acting within the scope of your duty and following the normal rules. And then you get a fact, that's a fact question, back and forth for a jury. And it's a threshold that has to be, it's a rebuttable presumption, but it starts out with the police officer having some form of protection. And then if the conduct is as egregious as we have seen it be, that conduct, that protection will fail. But I do applaud him for raising this question because it is something that needs to be addressed. And the courts have gone amok with this. Republican judges since like 1980s have had this as an absolute bar to claims that were meritorious.
All right. Well, it'll be interesting to see where this conversation goes at the federal level in the coming weeks and months. Well, Indiana universities will not be able to bring many skilled international professors and researchers to the state until 2021. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Justin Hicks reports that's due to an executive order from President Trump this week designed to protect American jobs.
The order says during a time of high unemployment, skilled foreign workers with H-1B visas pose, quote, an unusual threat to the employment of American workers. Indiana colleges like Purdue and Indiana University employ hundreds of professors under the program, as well as researchers. Hannah Buxbaum, Vice President of International Affairs at IU, says it currently has about 350 employees with H-1B visas. She says universities and industry both rely on the ability to recruit skilled international workers to strengthen the economy.
For the long-term success of American companies, you know, it is absolutely critical that we be able to attract the best researchers.
Buxbaum added that the order is prohibiting around 20 current and prospective employees who are out of the country from entering.
John Schwanes, we talked last time about a balance. Does this executive order strike the right balance?
I'm not sure it does. This seems pretty problematic. My opinion is really doesn't matter as much as the experts who deal with these sorts of issues day in and day out. And they say this is going to hurt the United States' effort to remain the hotbed of development and cutting-edge technology as it relates to STEM fields. It also probably will hurt some of the areas that are already where healthcare resources are stretched very thin, because this would apply even to, you know, physicians and healthcare workers at the time of a pandemic. And it just seems to be perhaps not the best approach at this time. If you cease to get the best and brightest, then those best and brightest are somewhere, and one would think that the opportunity and the jobs and the growth might follow them long term. So I think there may be some regret at some point down the line here in having issued this order.
Nikki, when you talk about Indiana specifically, where you have institutions like Indiana University and Rose Holman and Purdue and Notre Dame, does this conversation around this executive order change a little bit because it's Indiana and given what we have here?
I mean, I'm sure most states have some good research facilities, so I'm not sure it impacts us any differently than others. And I would hope it's at least temporary. I will say this, occasionally during the Trump administration, we have seen that they sometimes don't think through the unintended consequences, and then they will dial it back.
All right. Well, finally, fireworks are in the news, as some people in some East and West Coast states and cities are struggling with an increase in the noisemakers this year, as many public shows are being canceled due to COVID-19. Of course, here in Indiana, fireworks season seems to last close to all year round. So Jennifer Hollowell, it is a controversial topic right now, but fireworks in the neighborhood, are you yay or nay?
Personally, I'm nay, but I do believe in freedom, and we're celebrating freedom, so I am very outnumbered.
Ann Delaney, yay or nay?
Nay, period.
Nikki Kelly, I know you have some cats, as do I. Yay or nay on this one?
Yeah, I got 2 acres, though, so we can do them no problem.
John, are you hearing fireworks all the time in Ohio there?
I I can put up with fireworks during holiday periods. I think that's part of the festivities. Now, maybe not so much in the middle of fall or middle of spring, but 4th of July, I'm good with it.
Well, I had two reasons this week to set off fireworks. One, the National Women's Soccer League starts play tomorrow with my hometown Chicago Red Stars, and Liverpool are the Premier League champions for the first time in 30 years. That is Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Stay safe, stay healthy, and join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.